So today's talk would be on case one of this book called Two Zen Classics. These are just, they really are classics as far as Zen literature goes. And they are a compilation of two books. One is called The Gateless Gate and the other is Blue Cliff Records. So this is the first koan from Gateless Gate collection called Joshu's Moon. And it would sound weird if you're not familiar with how Zen literature works. It's very paradoxical, very evocative, wild. It's wild. And hopefully we will unpack some of this as we go along. A monk asked Joshu, "Has a dog the Buddha nature?" Joshu answered, "Bah." Mumon's comment, "In order to master Zen, you must pass the barrier of the patriarchs. To attain the subtle realization, you must completely cut off the way of thinking. If you do not pass the barrier and do not cut off the way of thinking, then you will be like a ghost clinging to the bushes and weeds. Now I want to ask you, what is the barrier of the patriarchs? Why? Is it this single word, mu? That is the front gate of Zen. Therefore, it is called the Mumonkan of Zen. If you pass through it, you will not only see Joshu face to face, but you will also go hand in hand with the successive teachers, entangling your eyebrows with theirs, seeing with the same eyes, hearing with the same ears. Isn't that a delightful prospect? Wouldn't you like to pass this barrier? Arouse your entire body with its 360 bones and joints and its 84,000 pores of the skin. Summon up a spirit of great doubt and concentrate on this word mu. Carry it continuously day and night. Do not form a nihilistic conception of vacancy or a relative conception of has or has not. It will be just as you have swallowed a red-hot iron ball, which you cannot spit out even if you try your hardest. All the illusionary ideas and delusive thoughts accumulated up to the present will be exterminated. And when the time comes, internal and external will be spontaneously united. You will know this, but for yourself only, like a dumb man who has had a dream and cannot talk about it. Then all of a sudden, an explosive conversion will occur, and you will astonish the heavens and shake the earth. It will be as if you snatch away the great sword of the valiant journal Kanmu and hold it in your hand. When you meet the Buddha, you kill him. When you meet the patriarchs or ancient teachers, you kill them. On the brink of life and death, you command perfect freedom. Among the sixfold worlds and four modes of existence, you enjoy a merry and playful samadhi. Now I want to ask you again, how will you carry it out? Employ every ounce of your energy to work on this mo. If you hold it without interruption, behold, a single spark and the holy candle is lit. At this point, it's customary to ring three bells, and then at the end of these bells, we all will bow together. So I bet that was weird to hear that monologue on this primal gate of Zen tradition called Mu. Before I get into talking about it, I just want to formally say thank you to all of you for coming. There is nothing that excites me, carries me, holds me, that like Zen. And I just wait for long sits and sessions with my whole being, head, heart, hara, everything. So it's wonderful to see all of you here and to feel that you are all also subconsciously wanting to taste that nectar that just nourishes me so deeply. Zen meditation teachers go through different kinds of training in different traditions, and even within Zen tradition, being a priest or being a teacher has different meanings in different traditions. So I just want to, it's like I've come to teach physics and I feel like, oh, I'm this Asian woman, I look small, I want to tell you something about what I have gone through, which makes me feel so passionate about this path. So in Zen tradition, it feels a little weird to say that, but in Zen tradition, you become a priest if you have done, anyway, different traditions are different, but you go through at least 40 to 60, 5 to 7 day retreats, which are silent, and where you sit in our tradition, you sit for 10 hours a day on your butt. Right? So if half a day feels a little tough, you do that for 5 to 7 days in a row and maybe 40, 50, 60 sessions. And then your teacher thinks, oh, okay, maybe you know a little something about Mo. You go through cons like these. This is the fundamental con. This con is like, we had always sort of done everything in our life sitting, and then we wanted to learn dancing, but the teacher said, your first step is learn to stand. So this con, working with Mu is like you're learning to stand. And then once you have learned to stand, is then you work with other koans, and there are 3,000 such koans in Zen tradition. And so you go through these koans, and at some point, and I was talking about this at one of our Thursday sits, you see the whole elephant, right? So what do I mean by that? Buddhism is, different traditions would define the goal of meditation practice a little differently. Okay? And one of the things I wanted to talk about today is this plurality in how people look at the goal of Zen practice or meditation practice or any spiritual practice for that matter. Right? So in Buddhism, a fundamental goal is, right, the initial goals are, I am feeling stressed out, my concentration is poor, I just want to feel a little sane and a little calmer, right? So, yes, those are initial goals, and they are very important in the crazy times we live in. They have always been important. Okay, but if you go deeper, the deeper purpose is, I really want to know what I am made of. I really want to know if I come from the same elements as stars, right, are made of, why don't I feel like stardust? Right? So it's this fundamental con, like what the heck is God or Buddha? What the heck is this enlightenment? Right? So in a lot of, especially in Asian tradition, they describe this enlightenment or this reality that we are trying to experience, not just talk about it, not just philosophize about it, right? Zen teachers actually are known to turn away philosophers. My teacher's teacher used to tell my teacher, who is an English professor and loved philosophy, you can't go anywhere in Zen because you read too many books, right? So it's not, books are very helpful, they inspire us, they give us a framework, but it's not about talking about things and sort of intellectually understanding them from this part of the body. It's sort of experiencing it, right? It's like I'm pointing at my hara. It's like experiencing it in your bones. So this whole thing about experiencing the reality, and in Asian traditions, they sort of compare this reality with many things. One of the very good analogies, with which we compare enlightenment is like an elephant, right? So you sit down, you straighten your back, you focus on your breath or whatever object of concentration your teacher has given you, and you sort of focus on it. And ultimately, especially in Zen, but in other traditions too, they say, please become like a blind, become blind, right? So you have your eyes closed, you can't see, but you have mental images coming in your mind of, you know, what did your boyfriend say? What did your wife say? What are you gonna eat? What is your next art or activist project? And these images are popping up back and forth. But when we sit down to meditate, these thoughts and sensations sort of fade away, you know, using different kind of meditation techniques. And then it's like you were falling into a space where these concepts are not there so prominently, and you are blind, right? You are blind. You are just like curiously exploring that space where these images and thoughts and feelings are a little bit distant. And then as a blind person, you just like, where am I going? What is this? Oh, this. It feels like wood, right? It has some kind of a hole. I can put my hands in it. And it has a handle. Okay. So, this is just an analogy, of course, right? So, you go and tell your teacher, or who's helping with your cons, I'm experiencing something which is hard, rigid, maybe feels like wood. And then underneath it, oh, there is this something soft. I won't keep talking about this wooden drum here. Going back to the analogy of elephant, you go and touch, let's say, and your eyes are closed, you're blind, you touch something hard and you say, oh, it feels like a tree trunk. In reality, it is the leg of the elephant, but you experienced it, given your state of mind, you experienced it as a tree trunk. And you say then, oh, there's not just one, there is two. And then you go and, you know, teacher gives you another koan maybe, and then the koans turn our direction to different aspect of same elephant. See, the elephant is the same, but different koans point to different aspects of the same reality. So then you turn around and then you experience something and you say, oh, this looks like a very thick rope. And it gets bushy at the end, you know, fibrous at the end. And that's elephant's tail. You didn't know it's elephant's tail, but what you experience at that given point of time feels like a rope. And then on and on, right? You could experience the elephant's head in a certain way, its flapping ears in a certain way. And then at some point, you see the whole elephant. Some point, there are deep experiences that it's the whole elephant comes, you meet the whole thing face to face, right? So, somewhere around then is when, you know, in our tradition, you get permission to teach, right? And then you just know it, right? You know the elephant, but you still don't know how to skillfully teach, right? And that's where I find myself, where I feel like we've just sort of started our group a couple of years ago and I've had lots of travel. So I get very excited when people want to practice Zen, but I am still learning to convey what needs to be conveyed, or I'm still learning to be skillful for different people in different ways, because I have only gone through my experience of going from koan, tail koan, to the trunk koan, to the leg koan. But it takes a while to really be skillful about how someone else can describe the same leg, if it makes any sense. Yeah? So going back to this koan called mu. Mu is about becoming blind and really, really experientially entering that state where you can begin to really be empty of all concepts. Really all concepts, right? So that you're really blind, and then when something comes your way, oh, it makes this sound. You are just totally blank and curious and receptive, so that even the concept of this being a wood doesn't come to your mind, right? It's like you experience the raw, complete rawness of the moment that arises after being blind. And mu is just so fundamental to Zen, right? Mu is not the ultimate whole elephant, but you cannot experience the elephant without passing through the gate of mu. And when we start our practice, a lot of you you've been coming here for a while, we start with breath koan. Breath is precursor to mu koan, right? So when we work with the breath koan, we say, okay, calm down, right? Slow down, close your eyes, straighten your back, breathe from your hara. When you exhale, right? Please do it with me as I'm saying it, right? When you exhale, before your next breath comes in, there is a space between your out breath and your in breath. Watch that space. Tell me what happens in that space. Right? And that's basically, it's like giving people, it's like a precursor koan to mukoan. But the idea is the same. What the teacher or the person helping you with koans is trying to ask you is, tell me how exactly you become blind in that space. And nobody else's answer can be your answer. Reading no amount of books, number of books, philosophy, English, literature will help you. You know, that experience I've had, right? Because I struggled myself. My teacher used to say, when he started working with the breath koan, he did everything under the sun to convince his teacher, Kenki Takabayashi Roshi, who was a Japanese and had come from Japan to teach in America. You know, it's like, and Genki used to say, you know, you are blind. Where does the breath with eyes go? See, you are blind means your thinking mind is at rest. Your conceptual mind, the mind that says right or wrong, I like it, I don't like it, that mind has gone off. Okay? It's been put aside. We are not saying get rid of that mind. That mind is wonderful, brilliant, necessary. We are saying put that on the side. When you put that on the side, that mind, thinking mind is blind. Your breath has eyes of its own. Where does the breath with eyes go? And my teacher he was so funny. He used to make us laugh like crazy in his talks. He said he brought poems to his teacher. He brought stories. He brought him an apple in Dokusan room once. It's really true. Like, you know, he used to read these Zen stories in books, and I don't know what he was thinking, but he used to bring all these things. So I won't tell you my teacher's answer, and I, you know, it's like everyone's answer is unique, but you can tell when it's really genuine experiential answer versus when we are thinking about the answer, right? So there are ways to tell whether we are really entering that blindness. The other thing that I wanted to say about mu, or this space that you can experience in different ways when you work with breath, is that that space is not something, I mean, it's magical in some ways, but on the other hand, it's so ordinary that it's always there. It's like this blue sky, right? I mean, such a gorgeous day today. I didn't look up the sky for too long, but I thought it was very clear a few times I did look up. Not too many clouds. Even if we are in a dungeon, in a basement, locked up in prison, right? Imprisoned by police, really can't see any light, even though it's daytime. The sky is always there, right? I mean, I'm sure all of you have had this experience where you're working very hard on your projects. If you are a student, you are a therapist, you are an artist, and you are inside. And even when we were busy finishing up our reports, talking to our clients, talking to our family, the sky is there all the time. right? It's not something that we conjure up with our will. It's always there. The question is, did we come out of the room and see it? And I'll go back to the elephant analogy. And then when you experience the sky for the first time, imagine however old you are, 20 years, 40 years, 60 years, 75 years. Let's say we've always remained indoors and never seen the sky. If you see the sky through this hole, right? When you go and report about this to your teacher, you will say, oh, the sky has, it's enclosed in a triangular boundary, right? Right now with my one eye, this looks like a triangular boundary. If you see it through a sieve, you will say, oh, it's the sky is blue, white, and then there is a mesh all over, right? So that's another aspect of our koan practice, is that the sky is the same and it's simple. It's always there, always approachable. But depending on what our life obstacles have been, our life experience is off the cushion, we experience that same reality in different ways. And so when we do koan practice, the koan practice, at first, you come up with your unique answers that describe that mesh, right? That I am looking at the sky through this mesh versus that mesh. And then the koan practice also takes away that mesh one by one. I hope it's making some sense. And it brings me back to the issue of plurality. Even within Soto Zen, so in Zen tradition, or if you go to even mindfulness tradition, the insight meditation tradition, it's the same nirvana that they talk about, right? It's the same blue clear sky or same elephant. But at different points of time, we experience different aspects of the same elephant and through different lenses, right? We see through different mesh sizes. The size of the mesh changes, the shape of the mesh changes. And it appears that their goals are so different. But in my view, they really are not. And some people feel like, you know, they say, oh, you know, the sky is always there. I am always with it. They think they do, and it's not always clear to me. I'm still making sense of it. If they really see it or if they are imagining seeing it. But what I do know from my experience is that when you go through this deep koan training, you are really tested at every step. You know, have you really taken your mesh apart? Have you really become blind? And have you really seen all aspects of that same reality? Have you really touched and inspected and lived through all parts of the elephant? And another related aspect is that, you know, one aspect of experiencing the elephant, and some traditions emphasize that more than others, is, let's say, equanimity. They'd say, oh, someone who has experienced Nibbana or Nirvana, Nibbana is Pali word and Nirvana is Sanskrit, It's like, if you really experience Nibbana, you are going to be equanimous, equanimity, right? All the time. Content, so content. But in my experience, that is one shade, one texture, one color of that elephant, but that's not all of it. In my experience, equanimity is absolutely one flavor and texture of the elephant, but that's not always true. When you face that elephant, where you are one with that elephant, you can also experience tremendous energy. Tremendous energy. It's like, whoa, where did it come from? Another aspect of it could be just like totally heartbreaking compassion. Right? It could be courage. It again depends on from which side, which road have we taken to approach that elephant? What are we facing? What is our life situation? So you cannot pin down that elephant to one quality. You cannot pin it down to patience. You cannot pin it down to courage. You cannot pin it down to brokenheartedness. Right? It includes everything. I really hope it makes some sense, because I think this is crucial. Sometimes we get attached to just one quality of that elephant, and then we try to it's limiting to think that only one quality symbolizes or epitomizes our experience of the elephant. So let's see. I don't know. You might be working on Mu. I don't know if any of you are. So I don't want to say too much more about it. But I hope all of you would experience all of these deep layers, different three-dimensional aspects of this elephant, right? It really, my life revolves around it. Even when I go about my day, my weeks, my months, traveling. I'm currently on sabbatical, but last 5 years I spent half my time in India, traveling in rural India. And after a few weeks of being in India, I used to get quite tired, really tired. And I wouldn't always have the time and space to be able to practice, to create that, carve out that space. And even though I've practiced for 16, 17 years now, it gets harder and harder without the community, right? Every now and then, you need to do it together to sort of really experience the depth of that elephant. And my state of mind when I haven't sat with a group or for a long time, like for the whole day or 5 day retreats, it's like I'm an anxious lover. It's like, where is my elephant? So I really hope that we will have chance to keep coming back together to sort of dip our toes in this pool, this sky, sort of meet this elephant. It's quite vast and quite amazing. So thank you so much.